You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today marked the first day of Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees. We'll look at the political back and forth as confirmations get underway.
Now, Governor Scott Walker gave his State of the State address this afternoon. We're analyzing the speech now with Charlie Jacobs.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to Governor Walker's State of the State address and the Democratic response from Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling? What parts of the speeches did you like? What do you wish the governor had mentioned but didn't? What issues are you watching for in 2017? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the theme of Governor Walker's speech, working and winning for Wisconsin, how did that theme come together over the course of that address?
I mean, I think he tied it in well with the major policy proposals that he was offering, and I think it sort of strikes the same kind of theme and dovetails well with what Republicans are hoping to do at the national level and the kinds of ideas that Trump has been promoting in the days running up to his inauguration. So I think that there was probably a hope to do that, as well as I think a little nostalgia there for Ronald Reagan and the line he used, "Are you better off now than you were 6 years ago?" So I mean, kind of beating the typical Republican drum on policy, and I think his theme connected to all of that.
And does this sound like a possible campaign slogan for someone running for re-election in a year?
Yeah, I think he kind of slipped and maybe showed his cards a little bit at one point when he talked about 2017 and beyond regarding finding workers for Wisconsin. So it sounded like he was kind of tipping his hat a little bit and indicating that there's a likelihood he's going to be running for another term in office.
And the governor painted Wisconsin with a rosy economic picture there, talking about reducing the taxpayer burden, among other things, to the tune of $4.7 billion. What else did he say there?
Well, I mean, I think he was trying to demonstrate that under his stewardship, we've seen a recovery that is matching, if not exceeding, most of the United States. Certainly giving a little credit or credence, I think, to anything that Barack Obama has done, which is not unexpected. But at the same time, I think, doing the sort of typical reflection on Doyle's administration and some of the stumbles that he saw running up to and through the recession as it started in 2008. So, I mean, I think what he was trying to do was focus on some of the real wins that we've seen in Wisconsin since he took office that have sort of matched what you've seen, the slow recovery on a national level as well.
Right. Senator Schilling talking about the set of data that the Democrats are more prone to refer to on lagging the national recovery rate on some measures. Governor Walker looking at the ones that look a little rosier. In general, are we just sort of tracking the recovery from the low points of the recession 2008 to 2010?
That's sort of been typical with Walker and his administration is they often, and you know, a lot of fact checkers have pointed this out, they use convenient dates and times to demonstrate sort of bolder outcomes than you might be able to necessarily demonstrate. And that's not to diminish what the governor has done and what the Republican legislature has done, because again, they have tracked sort of the national recovery. In some measures, we've lagged a bit, but in others, we've been quite good. In fact, if you look at some of the Bureau of Labor Statistics over the last couple of years, our average wage has increased at a rate that's been greater than at the national level. Now, we've lagged in job creation, so you know, you sort of have a yin and a yang with some of these data. But, I mean, it's typical of any administration, Democratic or Republican. You are going to try to find the silver lining anywhere you can to sort of burnish your bona fides and make the public feel positive about your stewardship of the state.
And Charlie, I want to switch over to one of the bigger surprises of this State of the State address, and that was some of Governor Walker's comments about the UW system. He again painted in good terms, talked about how it had moved up the rankings, talked about college debt, and that's when he talked about his idea for the future.
College affordability was also a major issue at our listening sessions, but it wasn't just students who raised it as a concern, as they're concerned about the cost of higher education. It was parents, grandparents, educators, and many others. That's why I'm pleased to announce that our 2017 through 2019 state budget will do more than just freeze tuition. We will actually cut, that's right, cut tuition for all Wisconsin undergraduates throughout the UW system.
So cutting tuition, not just unfreezing tuition, which has been the case for a while now, but cutting it, is that a big surprise to you, Charlie?
It is, and I think it's probably a big surprise to those in the UW system who crunched the numbers. I mean, they asked for the third largest appropriation among all the departments of government, including more than 2% increase in operating funds. So I'm wondering what that's going to do to their projections and what the likely effects it's going to have on staffing, on class sizes, and the like, because there has to be some sort of give and take if you're going to cut tuition dollars. I mean, you've seen UW try to plug some holes by increasing out-of-state tuition, which of course might alienate some students from coming to Wisconsin. So it's going to be an interesting conversation, and I think UW is going to want to see how these numbers work out when the governor finally delivers his budget and offers his more detailed budget address.
Talking about Governor Walker's State of the State Address with Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College. We'll go to a caller now. Gordon is on the line in Wisconsin Rapids. Gordon, hi.
Hey, guys. Hey, great show. You know, I love the tuition freeze, and the tuition cut means it's less that we have to pay for our daughter at Point to go to college, and less she'll have to pay back when she gets out in the working world, and it's fantastic. You know, it's I just heard that UW Stevens Point got $1 million donation for their one of their programs, the natural resources. So there's money out there to be had, and cut them and freeze it. It's great.
Gordon, thanks for the call. So one parent there of a Stevens Point, UW-Stevens Point student, happy with this cut. But as you say, Charlie, it changes the math for UW officials here.
And remember, there was an act passed a couple years back that asks for some other formulations from departments. You know, if their budget had to be zero growth or had to be a 5% cut, what would you do? And UW's reaction was, we're going to have to lay off a lot of staff, you know, faculty and staff, in order to accommodate either zeroing out our budget or reducing our budget. And I mean, while as a parent who has a son who's about to go to school, I understand the concerns about the sticker price for a lot of these schools, both public and private, and it can be shocking and really take your breath away. But at the same time, in order to control costs, there are trade-offs to be made. And so parents have to be aware and students have to be aware that there are going to be some ramifications if budgets drop because tuition dollars disappear for these administrators.
Governor Walker seemed to be making the case that tuition has been frozen for a while now, but that the UW is still managing and rising in the ranks. He mentioned UW going up in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. Didn't mention UW slipping out of the top five research universities for the first time in 45 years, according to the National Science Foundation. So is that going to be a battle point about how well the UW is managing to weather some of these cuts?
I think that is certainly going to be a data point for the UW system to point to. I'm not sure how well that's going to resonate with those in the Assembly, in the Senate, and with the governor. I don't know whether or not they find that a significant priority and whether or not they think that slip is short-term or something long-term and what kind of effect it's going to have. Governor Walker has always impressed me as somebody who's very student-centered in the sense of wants to be sure that students and their families can afford the process. And I think you see some of that in the discussions about that course that's being objected to by some members of the legislature regarding race and whiteness in the population. I think that sometimes they focus on some of the operation of the university system that seems tangential to what the students should be doing in the classroom. And so I think that it's going to be difficult for UW to sort of point to those kinds of things and convince the governor and others that that's where the money should be going.
We're talking with political scientist Charlie Jacobs right now, talking about Governor Scott Walker's State of the State Address.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the governor's speech? What caught your attention? What was missing, do you think, in what the governor had to say and in what Senate Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling had to say in response? What issues are you watching for in 2017 in the state budget as well? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion now about Governor Scott Walker's State of the State address this afternoon. Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College is with us analyzing the speech.
And we want to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think were the big themes of Governor Walker's speech? What were the highlights? And what do you think the governor left out that you think maybe needed more attention, more focus? You can call us at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
The governor also talked about K through 12 education. Here's a listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
And families, particularly low-income families all across the state, now have more quality choices in education. For many, like my family, it'll be a traditional public school. For others, it will be a choice or a charter school. Some will choose a virtual school, while others prefer to homeschool their children. Whatever the option, when it comes to making the right choice for their daughters and sons, I trust parents.
Charlie, we've seen increases in voucher aid for parents around the state. The voucher program started smaller just in the Milwaukee area, been added to more areas. Are we expecting to see more expansion in the coming budget?
I would expect so. I mean, this is something that the Republicans and the governor have pursued, and they may get a boost with Donald Trump's selection for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. I mean, she has been an advocate just like Governor Walker has for years, and she's supported it with her pocketbook and supported it in states nationwide. So I think that you may see some educational dollars coming at the federal level to support some of these, and that's going to help the effort here in the state for the government in pursuing this policy issue.
And the governor did say he was planning on allocating more money to public education, emphasis on rural schools and the needs there. Is that something that Wisconsinites have been looking for?
Yes, because of some changing demographics and some changing conditions. So many of the costs for schools are fixed, and if you start losing population or losing student enrollment, those fixed costs don't typically go away, but the tax dollars that are flowing into any local school district drop. So this is a way to sort of offset that change that's occurring to try to help sustain the quality of education in the rural areas, even though they're losing population.
Let's bring in a caller. We've got Tony on the line in Madison. Tony, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you very much. My daughter goes to UW-Stevens Point, too, and I just think the analogy you got to draw is like, yeah, tuition might be cheaper and the freezing of the cuts, but the quality of the education is much worse since Walker Republicans have taken over. If compare the UW used to be a Cadillac Escalade, and right now it's a Ford Pinto, but you're paying, yeah, so what if you're paying a little bit less? Quality of education has gone down. It's harder to get classes that the kids want,
Tony, I gotcha. So concern there from a parent that, okay, maybe I'm paying a little less. Am I getting the quality of education? I'm sure, Charlie, this is something we'll be hearing in the argument over a tuition freeze and what happens to UW funding coming up.
I'm sure that one of the arguments we're going to hear is that the quality may stay the same, but the opportunity to take the courses you want or need might disappear. And so the offset may be that you're going to save dollars per semester, but you may need a semester or two more to graduate because you couldn't get into the classes you need because they were capped at a certain number or there weren't sufficient faculty or staff to help run these. So that's going to be an argument you're likely to hear from Democrats and also from the UW system advocates itself.
And the governor also talked about welfare reform, wanting Wisconsin to be a leader there, pushing the federal government for more latitude in that direction for the state. What did that seem to say to you about direction coming up, Charlie?
This is something that both the governor and Republican governors in other states have been pushing, things like drug testing for particular welfare benefits and the like. And some of these can be approved. Some of these need approval by the federal government. Some do not. And some states have certainly tested these kinds of ideas. What we've seen with a lot of these testing programs in particular for access to benefits through drug testing is that they're rather expensive and don't save the requisite money to offset the cost of the testing program. And of course, there have been claims, although not tested specifically in courts, at least not at the United States Supreme Court level, that there might be a constitutional infirmity in particular related to the Fourth Amendment and an illegal search related to this kind of drug testing.
Let's go back to listening to Governor Walker in the speech now on an issue that's going to be a big deal, maybe a big debate among Republicans in the budget, transportation. Here's a listen.
Last year alone, there were more than 300 road construction projects going on in the state. You probably drove through one of them. Looking ahead, we'll provide local governments with the largest increase in transportation aids since the 1990s.
And the governor compared, he said he'd spent $18 billion on road projects in a six-year period compared to $16 billion in the six years before that. People point out that's not much more than the rate of inflation a little bit. And then this idea that he'll spend more but no revenue increases. This will be something interesting to watch in the budget, Charlie.
It will, because it will likely mean more borrowing, and there are some Republicans who are as adamantly against borrowing money for these projects as the governor is for increasing taxes. So I think that's where you're going to see individuals butting heads. I suppose there's some hope by many, not just Republicans in the state legislature, that Trump is able to convince the Republicans in Congress to open up the federal coffers and provide those infrastructure funds that he promised. I mean, he argues kind of this almost Depression era-like infrastructure program to help bolster those elements in the United States. The problem is there may be an unwillingness by Republicans at the national level to do that. So I'm not sure whether or not they want to kind of count on those kinds of dollars coming into the state to help offset either the borrowing or a potential tax increase.
We're talking to Charlie Jacobs right now from St. Norbert College, looking at Governor Walker's State of the State address delivered just this afternoon. And we'll take another caller now. We've got Zach on the line with us in Waupaca. Zach, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this is politics as usual. Anytime there's anything that's all rosy, then we really probably aren't talking about the real issues or the problems that the citizens are having. And I think this is demonstrated through both the egregious things going on with campaign financing and outside money dictating policy that Walker is choosing. And also there's now bipartisan support with Schultz and Collins that the gerrymandering that's happened in our state is completely undemocratic. I think these are huge problems, and I'm afraid our citizens are going to sleep on them.
Zach, thanks a lot for the call. And Charlie, was the picture from Governor Walker out of line with what you might normally hear in a state of the state? Would you expect to hear a governor to say, you know, we need to do better on Area X?
No, I mean, these are typically partisan speeches. They are rallying cries, especially when you have unified government, as you do here in the state, to hopefully convince the assembled members of the state legislature to pass your priorities and to demonstrate that the party in power is doing well. I don't think he was egregious in the way in which he promoted the party and promoted the good work that they've done over the last several years. That's typical. I think it's incumbent upon Democrats, if they want to gain traction with the public, to make their case and make it well. They have to be able to demonstrate clearly to the public that the state is on the wrong track, to try to undermine the arguments that Walker was making today. Whether or not they're going to be able to do that with their small numbers in both the Assembly and the Senate remains to be seen. But those are the kinds of things that the Democrats have to do.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jan is on the line in Douglas County. Jan, hi.
Hi. I, too, am concerned about the narrow focus of Governor Walker's speech. Both environment and climate change were not present in the discussion, and certainly not only the long-term viability of the University of Wisconsin, which is a main research institution, but to prevent DNR people from even discussing climate change and much less dealing with it is almost treasonous.
Jan, thanks for the call. Jan saying need to hear more about climate change and the environment, and of course possible changes, some calls for different kinds of reorganization, maybe drastic changes coming up at the DNR, Charlie.
Yeah, that's been in the news lately that, you know, there were some inquiries about, you know, what the climate change statements were online, and then they got scrubbed. And so now there's a different statement about sort of the equivocal nature that DNR will take when it comes to the data that's up online and the way in which the DNR is going to treat those kinds of data in the future. I mean, I think Jan is pointing out that, of course, any partisan is going to focus on those issues that he or she thinks are most important in a speech like this. And I agree with Jan that there were elements of the environment and other things that were lacking. One of the other things that I found lacking was no real focus on urban politics or the issues of the major urban centers in the state. No talk about Milwaukee, no talk about policies to help improve those areas. One small focus on Kenosha there at the very beginning of the speech. But, you know, it's a central component of state politics and one that has been a challenge, I think, both for the mayor of Milwaukee and for the governor. And that was really lacking in the speech about if there's a policy agenda for addressing some of the urban issues that face us.
And Charlie, as we start to wrap up, the governor's budget address is what's up next. Any hints in today's State of the State about what kind of territory he might cover in that speech?
You know, I think we heard the major themes. Education is going to be big, workforce training. I expect you're going to see the technical college get some sort of boost, as well as those programs he was touting regarding apprenticeships and internships, even at the high school level, discernment kinds of programs for students. So those are sort of positives to help fill those 80,000 open jobs that he pointed to. But at the same time, you know, we rank about 36th in the country in job growth. So it's not just about getting those jobs filled, but also about increasing the number of jobs in the state. So I think that's going to be something you're going to see in the budget as well that kind of meshes with this idea of workforce development. So I suspect there's going to be programmatic dollars for that as well.
Charlie, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. He joined us for analysis of Governor Scott Walker's State of the State address delivered just this afternoon.
Coming up, Senate confirmation hearings began today for Donald Trump's cabinet nominees, beginning with arguments over Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions. We'll hear the latest. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 8, join us for live coverage of President Obama's farewell address to the nation. That's tonight after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Right now, today marked the first of several Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Trump's nominees to key positions throughout his administration.
Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama started things off today looking for confirmation as Attorney General of the United States. And throughout his hearing today, he answered tough questions from his colleagues on issues ranging from abortion to immigration.
And more nominees will face Senate panels throughout the next couple of weeks, including Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of State Rex Tillerson tomorrow. Susan Johnson joins us now for more. She is an associate professor of political science at the UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, the attorney general is in some ways one of the most important positions. The person in that job has a lot of discretion on which kind of laws they prioritize. This is one of the big deals, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree that in terms of prosecutorial discretion, in terms of looking at interaction with law enforcement at state and local levels, in terms of all sorts of different policy areas, the Attorney General is one of the most important cabinet positions.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about Senator Sessions?
Well, he has been in the Senate for about two decades. He's from Alabama. He's quite conservative. He was one of the early supporters of Donald Trump. So if we think back to the summer and fall when many members of the Senate Republican caucus were not as keen on Donald Trump, Sessions was one of those who came forward early and supported him. He's known as a law and order type, going back to his days from when he was a federal prosecutor in Alabama. And he has the distinction of he was nominated for a federal judgeship and was forced to, this is going back 30 years, and was forced to withdraw his nomination as a result of some controversy in regard to his work when he was a U.S. attorney.
And he was, as we heard in the news, interrupted by protesters during the hearing today. What do people see as potentially controversial about him?
Well, it's interesting because the protesters were chanting things like KKK and other things related to, there's things in his history regarding the reason why he withdrew his nomination to be a federal judge back, like I said, a few decades ago, was because of some concerns that were raised, some serious concerns that were raised about his role as not supporting civil rights. Some talk of disparaging remarks he made about the NAACP going back, disparaging remarks he made to individuals, minority individuals who worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So at that time, it was quite a big issue. What's interesting to me is that as I look at what happened today in the hearings, while there were those protesters who, when they would raise their voices, were quickly removed from the hearing room, the senators who were questioning him really didn't focus on those issues to the extent that I guess I expected that they were going to.
Well, let's get into some of what they did ask Senator Sessions, their colleague Senator Sessions, about. As you mentioned, Sessions, a longtime supporter of President-elect Trump during the campaign. He was called out during the hearing today by Judiciary Committee Chair, fellow Republican Chuck Grassley, for comments he'd made about then-candidate Hillary Clinton and the scandal surrounding her emails. Here's a little bit of that exchange.
You've been nominated to serve as Attorney General. In light of those comments that you made, some have expressed concern about whether you can approach the Clinton matter impartially in both fact and appearance. How do you plan to address those concerns?
Mr. Chairman, it was a highly contentious campaign. I, like a lot of people, made comments about the issues in that campaign with regard to Secretary Clinton and some of the comments I made. I do believe that that could place my objectivity in question. I've given that thought. I believe the proper thing for me to do would be to recuse myself from any questions involving those kind of investigations that involve Secretary Clinton and that were raised during the campaign.
Now, since the election, Donald Trump has backed away, it seems, from the idea of pursuing investigations of Hillary Clinton and the email and the lock her up chants that were common at Donald Trump rallies. What do you think this idea of Attorney General Sessions recusing himself if this does become an investigation?
I think it's very important for listeners to understand that these confirmation hearings and all confirmation hearings, frankly, are there's a bit of political theater that's going on, or that question was asked intentionally so that, I mean, remember, this is a Republican senator who was asking him this question, and it was asked so that Jeff Sessions could say exactly what he said, which was that he would recuse himself, and that was meant to provide assurances to people who might be skeptical of the nomination and then of Senator Sessions, that in fact he would not engage in that behavior. And I mean, just to be clear, both sides do this. And so it's an important, I guess it's just an important distinction to make.
Talking about the opening day of confirmation hearings for Donald Trump's appointees, Susan Johnson is with us, political scientist from UW-Whitewater. Let's go back to the questioning. Immigration has been something that people are watching Senator Sessions on, and this is one of those issues that's within sort of the discretionary power of the Attorney General. Where do you focus on the law? Senator Lindsey Graham asked Sessions how he'd approach undocumented immigrants, specifically people who were brought into the country illegally as children. Didn't really answer the question to other senators liking, notably Democrat Dick Durbin of Illinois. Here he is challenging Sessions on immigration.
Senator Sessions, there's not a spot of evidence in your public career to suggest that as Attorney General, you would use the authority of that office to resolve the challenges of our broken immigration system in a fair and humane manner. Tell me I'm wrong.
Well, you are wrong, Senator Durbin. I'm going to follow the laws passed by Congress. As a matter of policy, we disagreed on some of those issues. I do believe that if you can continually go through a cycle of amnesty, that you undermine the respect for the law and encourage more illegal immigration into America. I believe the American people spoke clearly in this election. I believe they agreed with my basic view, and I think it's a good view, a decent view, a solid legal view for the United States of America, that we create a lawful system of immigration that allows people to apply to this country, and if they're accepted, they get in. If they're not accepted, they don't get in.
Ending potentially what President Obama had done by executive order, deferring deportation, especially for people who are brought here as kids without authorization. What are you looking for from an Attorney General Sessions with immigration, Susan?
Well, I think that we've seen clearly through the president-elect and through the people that he's nominated, including Senator Sessions, that we are going to potentially see a change in immigration policy. What was interesting when you played that clip to me was the comment that what Senator Sessions said was that he would follow what had been passed by Congress. And then he specifically didn't mention executive order. And clearly, the way executive orders work is that President-elect Trump, when he's the president, can rescind that order immediately upon taking office. Jeff Sessions has been historically quite conservative in regard to immigration, and so nothing he said there really surprised me.
Looking more widely at the various confirmations going on, there are a lot of them this week. Some have been postponed. Education Secretary nominee Betsy DeVos, she's been postponed, originally scheduled to be this week. Democrats are saying too fast and then raising concerns that ethics reports haven't been filled out, various kinds of FBI information not in place. Democrats pointing toward a memo sent by now Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell when President Obama was making his appointments, asking for exactly those things before hearings start. What do you make of that back and forth over background checks and things like that before the hearings start?
Well, I thought that as far as political theater goes, Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader, taking that letter that Mitch McConnell had received and just jotting a few changes, so Dear Mitch versus, you know, Dear Harry, I thought that was good because it got people looking at it and paying attention. I think that there's a couple of distinctions in terms of questions that you brought up. In terms of whether or not there's just a lot going on and is this different, it's not unusual for there to be hearings kind of stacked up the way they are. And if you know, people have gone back and written a lot about this, and, you know, looking back at both the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, I'm sorry, the Obama administration, there were hearings that were scheduled back to back like they are right now. The big difference has to do with the submission of the required ethics paperwork. And that's where there's a big difference between prior administrations and their nominees and the nominations that we're currently considering.
Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. We're looking at Senate confirmation hearings for Donald Trump's cabinet appointees.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think that the confirmation hearings should have been postponed as Democrats requested? Are there any nominees that stand out to you, either positively or negatively? And what do you think of the potential incoming administration? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to join the conversation.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about the Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you been following Senator Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearing today? What do you think so far? What message do you think the Trump nominees are sending? And are there nominees that you strongly support or maybe ones that you're concerned about? And should Democrats put up a fight on any or maybe all nominees or go along with the president-elect's choices? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, getting back to the ethics issue, The appointees here, a lot of them very wealthy, big business connections, Exxon, Amway, Air, Goldman Sachs, people with a lot of backgrounds, a lot of complicated financial portfolios and a lot of connections. Is this something that is worth spending more time on up front, do you think, to make sure any ethical issues are sorted out and divested from where they come up?
Well, it's required that this happen, and it's part of the nomination process. And in fact, when I was going through trying to, you know, prep to be on with you this afternoon, I was looking for other instances where this paperwork hadn't been filed. And when you read the official documents, it's just a statement that the paperwork will be filed, and it's actually written that it will be filed before the nomination is formally submitted to the Senate. So, I mean, that's what's unprecedented here, is the fact that we have a situation where this ethics process, which has gone on this way, is not happening in the way that it has historically. And furthermore, I would say that part of the issue is, as you mentioned, how complicated these people are. So we're going to have the wealthiest cabinet ever, and it's very complicated. And so part of the problem that the ethics office is dealing with has to do with the fact that this is very different from a cabinet that would be filled with perhaps more career people who have spent their careers in government or doing other things. This cabinet is very heavy on people who have spent their careers in the business world, and therefore it's much more complicated.
Let's talk about the role of Democrats here. They are the minority party in the Senate, thanks to rules changes passed by Democrats in the previous administration. The filibuster isn't as big an option, but they can slow things down. They can do a lot of, as you mentioned, political theater of their own if they want. How are Democrats going to balance the role between objecting to people slowing things down and not wanting to appear obstructionist?
I think that they're going to pick and choose. Clearly, what we saw today with Jeff Sessions is that the Democrats decided that they were not going to make this particular nomination one of the ones that they were going to focus in on. It was, as confirmation hearings go, pretty congenial. And I think that they're going to look at, and you mentioned Rex Tillerson earlier for Secretary of State, I think his is likely to be much more contentious, with more questions that are more pointed at some of his business dealings. Word came out yesterday that perhaps Exxon Mobil was engaged in business through a subsidiary with countries that were on the state sponsors of terrorism list. So I think there's some things there that they're going to want to go at, but definitely picking and choosing their targets.
Let's stay with Rex Tillerson for a moment. He is one nominee who's at least drawn questions from Republicans in the Senate, John McCain and others, worried about his connections, his past work with Russia, especially given their concerns about Donald Trump's attitude toward Russia. Is this a case where Republicans might be raising as many questions as Democrats?
We're certainly seeing Republicans raise questions, like you said, and particularly in regard to Russia. But I don't know that any of the Republican concerns are going to raise to the point where that nominee is in jeopardy, unless, of course, we see other things come out of the hearings that we haven't learned so far.
It isn't terribly common, looking back now, for nominees to be derailed, is it?
No, not really, particularly in terms of getting to the point where there's a vote and then they're rejected. What we do see from time to time are presidents withdrawing their nominees. So we were talking with the Attorney General before. Bill Clinton, it took him three tries before he got a Attorney General nominee that was able to go through the entire confirmation process. People might recall that in 2008, Barack Obama had nominated Tom Daschle to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, and some ethics issues came up there, and he was forced to withdraw his nomination. So more often than not, what you see, if things come up, are people withdrawing their nomination.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about the nominee confirmation process. It kicked off today in the Senate with Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions meeting with his current colleagues. We don't always see sitting senators get a nomination, Susan. Is there sort of a collegiality that might lead to fewer tough questions being asked?
Yeah, absolutely. And what we saw was a lot of the theme from the Republican side tended to be, we know you, you're a good guy, and he kept going back to that as well. So you had this Republican senators referencing that he is one of us, and you had him referencing that he is one of them. And so I would think that definitely, and across the aisle as well, you're going to have more collegiality in the hearings when the person that you're speaking to is someone that you've served with, some of them for two decades, as I mentioned.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Josie on the line in Sheboygan. Josie, hi.
Hi. I think that they're going to delay and delay and delay, and they won't hand in those documents that they need to. And then maybe some scandalous things will come out after they're already confirmed. You know, it's just such – I still can't believe that he was elected. I think something terrible is going to happen. It's going to be a huge mess. I heard that he got $900 million or something from Putin, from Russia.
Josie, let's stay with the cabinet confirmation side of things here. And Josie raising the possibility that, okay, these ethics forums don't get in as required. The Senate confirms a nominee anyway, and then something bad comes out and you've got a seated cabinet official having a potential scandal, Susan.
Well, and honestly, that can always happen where something gets missed in the vetting process. What Mitch McConnell has promised is that there would be no formal votes until all this paperwork is filed. Now, that being said, the fact that there's still some that hasn't been filed and it doesn't give people, the ethics office, much time to go through things, I think is concerning. But I would point to the fact that Republicans have gone ahead and rescheduled some hearings, as you mentioned earlier, in response to all of these concerns. So I feel like the Republicans are listening to the extent that, whereas they were originally going to have these all stacked up this week, they pushed some back to next week, knowing that people want these forms to be submitted.
Thanks for the call, Josie. A non-cabinet appointee is getting some attention this week, someone who doesn't have to be confirmed by the Senate. Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, apparently going to get a senior advisor official position. People are raising a nepotism, anti-nepotism law passed in the late 1960s, apparently in, partly in response to John F. Kennedy appointing his brother, Robert Kennedy, to as U.S. Attorney General some years earlier. Is this going to be a big conflict, do you think?
Well, I think that the outer office to the Oval Office is getting pretty crowded now. We have these various appointments of senior advisors and special advisors, and so his son-in-law is now the latest of those appointments. And you're right, people are raising this issue of whether or not this poses a conflict of interest. Trump says it doesn't. Others say that it does. Somebody could certainly file a suit arguing that, in fact, the law is being violated. But absent that, that can go through. Like you mentioned, it doesn't require Senate confirmation.
We'll leave it there for now. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
We've been talking to Susan Johnson. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She joined us to talk about the Senate confirmation hearings that began today with Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions of Alabama. You can share your thoughts on that process over at the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll be bringing these issues back up as they move along.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.